Broadcasting from Youngstown, Ohio, this is the MV Red Podcast, the show where we talk about news and politics impacting the Mahoning Valley, the state of Ohio, and the USA. If you want to subscribe to our podcast, find us on your favorite podcast streaming app or visit our website, www.mvred.com. If you want to share your opinion with us, please email info@mvred.com, as we would love to hear from you. Now, let's get things started. Here are your hosts, Michael Metzinger and Dane Davis.
All right. First off, I want to apologize. I had some technical difficulties, and we're trying to prevent that for this entire episode, unlike the last one, which was a complete train wreck. But thank you, everybody, for tuning in today. My name is Michael Metzinger, and joining me is my co-host, Dane Davis. Dane, how are you doing on this nice, mild Sunday evening here?
It's a beautiful day. It's 72 degrees. I saw my parents in Newton Falls. I played with the kids outside, and we went for a walk. It is really a fantastic day. I slept in a little bit. I'm a little mad at myself for sleeping in on such a nice day like this. But this is like, you know, people rag on Ohio's weather, but days like this make it completely worth it because it's just perfect.
So I forgot you're from Newton Falls. So what's your favorite restaurant in Newton Falls? We may have had this discussion before.
I grew up, there are two main restaurants. There's the Cover Bridge Inn, and there's Robbie Lee's. I'm a big fan of the Cover Bridge Inn, and that's not an offense to Robbie Lee's, but the Cover Bridge is the best. They have excellent steak, excellent prime rib, the best wedding soup I've ever had, and really good pasta. Cover Bridge Inn punches above its weight. It's a great little place. It's right there in the downtown too, so you're supporting local business. But all the restaurants in Newton Falls are really good. There was one called Faces Cafe. They had their best burgers. Fortunately, they shut down. The bar sold, but the cafe shut down. But
not to go into too many details with my work, but I have in the past worked on a client out that way in Newton Falls, and the big thing every day right around 11:55 is where are we going to go for lunch in Newton Falls? And it's usually kind of down to like four or five places.
Right.
I'll be honest though, Covered Bridge, not really. I think I've gone there maybe twice. And okay. I think I've been at HBK now 7 years. It's usually a place I don't want to say we avoid. It just never even comes up as a contender. Doesn't even come up as a contender.
Really? Really? Do you have any strong opinions? Like, have you been there? Did you eat there or had a bad
time? One time I got like, I don't know if they were not chicken nuggets, chicken fingers. They were, the other time I got soup. The soup was pretty good, but
yeah.
Well, I'm not complaining about it. I mean, it's just, there's some of us who are, I'm not one of them, but some are like devout Robbie Lee's followers and love Robbie Lee's. And then I'm more of a guy who loves the Big D's hamburger joint.
Big D's. Yeah. That's so fun fact. Dylan used to work at Faces, right? And the Faces shut down. Dylan started Big D's. So that's like the spiritual successor to Faces Cafe. No, listen, Robbie Lee's is great. My family went to Robbie Lee's all the time, and I love all the restaurants. They're all great. I think you should support local business as much as possible. So, everywhere you go in Newton Falls, it's a good time. It's a great community, really welcoming and nice. So,
yeah. I also like where Faces was. There's a Mexican restaurant, which I like. I forget what it's called. Not real sure.
Mi Amigo. Mi Amigo, my friend.
Mi Amigo. That's it. Yes. Yeah. I have a coworker who's a big Mi Amigos fan.
Yeah. Funny thing is, I've been to Mi Amigo a couple times, and I thought it was good, but people really love Mi Amigo for whatever reason. Like people from outside of town, right, who have had lots of different places. My favorite Mexican place, and I don't know how we're talking about food, but is El Jalapeno and Niles. Have you been to El Jalapeno?
No, have not. I have heard things about it, though.
It's really, really good. It's really, really good. It's Salsitas was good too, but Salsitas shut down in Austin Town. But El Jalapeno was a good successor.
Yeah, I was. There was a time there growing up that we went to, because I grew up in Austin Town. We went to Salsitas sometimes at least once a week, sometimes multiple times, like multiple times a week, which that quickly ended. But
yeah.
I'm not sure how we got into the whole food discussion.
let me add one more point, then we'll move on to the spicy stuff, right? When the thing about Mexican food is, or at least Tex-Mex, American Mexican food, is it's really good, but you can only do it like once a week, right? Like if you can do it multiple times a week, that's a lot to handle because it's super heavy. And it will, if you do it right and you get all the chips, the salsa, the queso fundido, all that stuff, right? It'll put you to sleep and you won't be able to eat anything for another week. So if you're doing Mexican food two or three times a week, then I don't know how you can do it. That's a lot.
Yeah. You got to have a strong digestive system is all I got to say.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, listen, here's the good news, Michael, right? The good news is there's nothing else going on in the political world in America. So we can talk about nothing at all this entire episode, right? Because there's literally nothing else happening that's political related. I mean, it's not like this is a controversial time or anything like that. So we can just talk about restaurants the entire time, you know, because there's just no political news, just none at all.
None. In this episode, I'm drinking here we go, Leinenkugel's Summer Shandy.
Oh, great. Yeah.
Yes. So, all right. Yeah. Obviously, there's a lot to talk about right now in the country following the death of George Floyd, which I want to say was probably close to a week and a half ago now. And so we're going to focus this episode on that, and especially the response to it, how America has responded to the death of George Floyd. It has been a remarkable time in this country, and something that on that, I don't think we really saw coming. The last three episodes, we've talked strictly coronavirus, and yeah, it seems as though the coronavirus, bye-bye, it's we're gone. Over it now. It is gone now. So, or it isn't gone, but it seems like, at least in the media's eyes, it's no longer worth being the top story anymore. And so we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
But there's so much to talk about. And, it's been a time where so many people have been brought into the process, not necessarily the voting process, but the process of current events and everything that's going on. I'm sure everybody has seen on social media posts related to it. And, it's been something to see. And, there's just a lot to talk about. So I guess, Dave, what are your initial thoughts?
And then where do we begin? What I think you're seeing emerge is, there's always the incident, which is the catalyst to whatever's going on. And there's the response to it. And then there's the subtext or the meta narrative or whatever. Right. So in this case, clearly there was this incident where George Floyd was killed. Police brutality, right? There was a 20-minute video or a 10-minute video that was released. People were watching it, it went viral. I think it happened on Monday or Tuesday, by Thursday of that week, protests across the country. So there's the incident, right? There's the response, and we've seen the massive mobilization of protests, intermittent with the protests were riots. Every company from Nickelodeon to Coca-Cola to the Oreo Corporation or Nabisco were tweeting out about like racism, Black Lives Matter. So there's that. And then there's like what's going on behind the scenes, right? And so here's my take. I think what you're seeing emerge is a new religion. And I think if you try to understand this through a typical lens, of left versus right, or, police brutality or even race relations, you're kind of actually falling short of a true understanding of what's going on. I think the way to view this and the way to view this movement is, first of all, people are laying off steam. They've been cooped up for months, right? So there's a lot of pent-up energy. People haven't been able to go to restaurants. They haven't been able to go to weddings or funerals or any of that, right? You have 30 million people unemployed, if not more. Maybe it's 40 million. I'm not sure the exact number. So there's huge pent-up unemployment. People are staying around. They're cooped up in their house. So there's this pent-up aggression and anger. But that's only one portion of it, right? I think America has seen its rates of religiosity decline. The mainline religions called Lutheranism, Presbyterianism, Episcopalianism, they're going to be extinct before this century is over are largely extinct. Catholicism, if it weren't for immigration, Catholicism would be in total decline. The only religions which seem to be doing somewhat well are evangelicalism and Mormonism, right? And some of the smaller ones like Islam and Buddhism, but they're growing because the numbers are so small. So religion in America is declining. We're having more and more people identify as agnostic or atheist, right? And more important than that is religion is dying, if not completely dead, among the elite, the upper middle class, the intelligentsia, right? I'm not talking about the very, very wealthy. I'm talking about that cohort of the population that fulfills the white collar workers, right? If you were to go into a corporate office meeting and you're saying, I'm a born again evangelical Christian, people would laugh you out of the room. They would. They would. Maybe they wouldn't do it to your face, but they would do it behind the scenes. Religion, if you said, I am a Orthodox Catholic, right? People kind of look at you funny because religion's kind of falling out of fashion, especially among this group. But the end of organized religion does not translate into the end of the religious impulse, okay? And people still have a religious impulse. And I think what we've seen is that this progressivism, which the Black Lives Matter movement is an offshoot of it. There's this new, it's a religious force. I don't want to say it's a religion, right? But it's a religious force, which is filling the void. So all these people that say, you know, oh, I am, I'm not religious. I only believe in science, right? They are acting and they're professing beliefs that have a quasi-religious take to it. And that's what's really, really scary because it's a fundamentalism. It reminds me of Marxism, right? Marxism filled the void of the European intelligentsia after the horror of the First World War, right? The First World War was horrible, and no serious person in Europe could believe in Christianity again after the worst they saw. So into the void came, you know, Marxism, into the void came fascism and Nazism, and all these really extremist ideologies came in. In America, right, there's been this discontent, and into the void has come this new religion. And the new religion operates similar to Christianity. And in fact, there are a lot of Christians that adopt measures of it. Similar to how, you know, in the third and fourth century in Rome, there were a lot of pagans who started to adapt Christianity, but they had a weird hybrid of the two. But it's different. It's fundamentally different. Like, let me give you an example. In Christianity, we had original sin, right? People were born with sin. In the new movement, we have white privilege. White privilege is kind of this ectoplasm that permeates through society that all white people have, right? In the old Christianity, you had to admit that you were a sinner to receive grace. Now, the new version is you have to admit that you're privileged to receive some sort of redemption. And it's a limited redemption, right? In the old religion, you had to pray. And you had to pray and ask God for forgiveness. And the new religion, you have to reflect. You have to be mindful. You have to meditate, right? The old religion had a canon of books and the Bible and letters. And there were prophets and epistles and stuff like that. The new religion has also a new canon, Ta-Nehisi Coates and Imraham Kendi, I think that's his name, and you know, bell hooks and Tim Wise, and you got to learn this canon, right? The anti-racism canon. In the old religion, and I'm going to stop this rant. I'm sorry if this is going on. In the old religion, you were either saved or you were damned. In the new religion, you're either anti-racist or you're a racist, right? And the old religion, there was a liturgical calendar. The Catholics have a liturgical calendar. Christianity has a liturgical calendar. In the new religion, we have a new liturgical calendar. February is Black History Month. June is Black Pride Month, right? And it's not a religion because it's not organized. There's clearly no pope. There are no priests or anything. But it's taken on, this new force has filled that void of religion. It's a new secular force that acts and operates and most importantly should be understood as a religious impulse, and it's satisfying the religious impulse of America's elites who are largely de-Christianized. So I'm going to stop there, but that's a big brain take. I don't know. Maybe that's too spicy.
That was a lot to handle there.
Yeah.
You came at that one from a perspective that I wasn't thinking of, but during that, you mentioned this idea of you're either racist or anti-racist or something along those. Yeah, and I've seen a lot of posts about that, especially, I forget which day of the week it was, this past week, where a lot of people were posting just a blank black image on their Instagram feeds or on social media feeds, and there's been various memes throughout the week, not memes, but I don't know, maybe there are memes, internet, you know, images that kind of symbolize what you're going for in that respect, And I kind of want to tie that into this whole element of just kind of Christianity. You hit it from this perspective of maybe this is more like a religious movement. And I'm thinking of it more from the perspective of Christianity in general, because there are certainly aspects of Christianity that are dying off in our country. But the last I had looked at, and I'm not sure if this is based on the 2010 census, but there were 240 million Americans that identified as Christians in this country. But to me, you know, if we were truly a Christian nation, we lived out our duties as Christians. Well, we see it like happen on social media with people going at each other's throats who don't even know each other, just immediately resort to hate. I don't want to say all the time it's hate, but a lot of anger. They let their frustrations out against their enemies and they just let it out. You know, if we truly were doing our Christian duty, and I'm not trying to get like overly religious here in any way, so that's not my goal here, but we're not called to like kind of go at people from the perspective they're our enemies. Let's attack them. You know, but we live in a nation where in some facets, it's become kind of taboo to live out your faith in this country. Like for me personally, like I'm not ashamed to admit I'm pro-life. Okay. I'm very pro-life. Okay. But that's kind of a controversial take. I kind of view it from the religious perspective that I'm pro-life and I believe life begins at conception. However, there is a large block of our country, many of which are Christian, who disagree with that notion. And people who agree with me are kind of hesitant to share that belief. And maybe they kind of cave and they're like, well, maybe I'm mostly pro-life, but I'll give you, you know, rape incest, those types of things. But we live in a nation where it seems as though some are nervous out of fear of retaliation for expressing their Christian faith. And I just think if we want to really change as a nation, we have to do a better job of doing our Christian duty of loving our enemies and loving your neighbor as yourself. And again, I'm not trying to get like overly religious here, but the thing that keeps coming back to me about this is so much of what we see going on, so much anger built up, but there's a lot of hate we see on social media right now. And if we all just kind of take a step back and say, you know what, it's okay to disagree. And I feel this is another point, and then I'll stop my rant here. It seems like anymore, people are afraid to disagree. And I don't know why that is, but it seems, I see it quite often, like your fear of disagreement. And like, disagreement, it's fine and it's healthy and a debate is healthy. It's when you go get personal and you attack each other. That's when it kind of, to me, crosses the line. So I know I'm all over the place.
No. So I think, can I build off of that, Michael? Because I think you hit some things that were really important, right? And well, you know, you go back to the English liberals of the 19th century. And one of the things that they argued for when they argued for freedom of speech and freedom of thought, right? Jeremy Bentham, Locke, John Stuart Mill, et cetera, was when you have vigorous debate, not only is there a pragmatic value, right? You can pick the best policy after debate and discussion, but there's a moral value, right? And the moral value is based off of this idea that human beings are inherently flawed creatures, okay? The idea of the perfectibility of a human is impossible, right? Everybody tries that. Like Marxism tried to build the new Marxist man, the Soviet man, right? They fail. You cannot perfect the human being. The human being has flaws, right? They have, you know, man can do great things, but he can also do really horrible things, right? There's the duality of man. It's a fallen creature, right? And that's important to keep in mind because that leads to a philosophy of limits and a philosophy of hesitation and a philosophy of incrementalism, right? And the point of this is that no big revolution can really change the fundamental nature of man, right? Like it's been tried. We had the French Revolution in the 1780s. We had the Soviet Revolution in the 19-teens. We had the German Revolution, the Nazi Revolution, right? Continually, we've tried to perfect human beings and it fails, okay? So that leads me to the point of view that debate and discussion is really good from a pure epistemological perspective, the fact that I could be wrong in whatever view I express at any given time, I could be full of error, that I can not only be wrong on the facts, but I could be wrong on the morality, right? That leads me to tolerate debate and discussion. Because if I engage in debate with a Michael or with somebody that disagrees with me, they might have the truth, right? And through debate and discussion, through the use of reason, we can reach the truth. That is a crucial view to maintain, but that view has gone completely out of the wayside in America. And in America today, you know, the idea of the fallen nature of man and the need for grace or some sort of salvation, right? And even if you were to secularize that, the need for debate and discussion has gone out of the way. In when we talk politics and we talk all these different things, the debates boil down to there's one side with pure truth and the other side with either ignorance or bad motives. And if you disagree, you're either ignorant of the facts, or if you're not ignorant, you have bad motives, you're evil, you know, you're full of some, you know, malcontent thought or that. Go back to the coronavirus debate, okay? Let's go back to this is crucial, the coronavirus debate. In the coronavirus debate, when this new virus first came on the scene, there were people that said, hey, maybe we should open up, right? Nobody called for an end to the quarantines right away because it was novel. But then we had more information. As we had more information, people wanted to open up. And the argument against those people was the following. You are either dumb, you don't know what you're talking about, you're ignorant redneck, right? Or you want to kill grandma. So again, going back to that, you're either ignorant or you have bad motives. Never was the argument was, maybe you actually have other facts. Maybe you have actually other knowledge. Maybe you have a different value rating of the risk probability or any sort of thing like that, right? There was never the good faith extended to the opponents. When it comes to this recent movement that we've seen here with the Black Lives Matter movement, there's actually room for lots of debate and discussion because no longer are we're talking one about a phenomenon and the specifics of the phenomenon, but we're also talking about the policy response. And I'll get into this and I'll turn it over to you. I mean, one of the policy responses we've seen is that we need to abolish or defund massively the police. And to me, that's a shocking idea. And look, I know that the argument is going to be, Dane, you know, you're just a lily vanilla white kid. You don't care. But assume that I do care for a moment. Maybe I disagree with these policies because I think that they're disastrous, right? The notion that if we defund the police, that all of a sudden or completely abolish the police, that that's going to lead to a more peaceful society or that. Here's what's going to happen in reality. The cities, right? They're going to be chaos. Okay. The suburbs are going to keep their police department. The suburbs are never going to give up their police department. So, you know, the white guys like me or the suburbanites, we're not going to lose our police department. We're going to be fine. Okay. The cities, if you abolish the police or you defund the police, you know, massively cut the police force, crime will go up. We know that for a fact. Crime will rise in response, okay? Who does that hurt? That doesn't hurt the Danes of the world, right? The very, very wealthy that choose to still live in the cities, they'll be able to afford privatized police force. Really what you're doing is you're taking a public institution which primarily benefits the middle and the working classes. You're abolishing it under the rhetoric of liberation, and then you're harming those working classes and those middle classes entirely. So there's room for debate. And the idea that you have to shout this slogan and you have to agree with it, or else, you know, you're full of hate, I think is completely, you know, completely untrue. Yet I want to end police brutality. I want to see a strong Black America because they're my fellow Americans and they're fellow human beings more fundamentally. But I disagree with a lot of these policies. I disagree with a lot of the facts. But you're not allowed to debate. You're not allowed to dissent. So I'll turn that over to you.
Yeah, so my big thing here is knee-jerk reactions.
Right.
Does change need to happen? Yes. There needs to be some sort of change. But a week after George Floyd is killed, we're going to defund the police departments, and that's going to solve our issues. I definitely question that. I think we really got to look at the core of what can be done, what practically can be done about this situation. There was a stat posted. It was a database from the Washington Post, 2019, the racial composition of unarmed people who were shot and killed by U.S. police in 2019. And looking here, there's 41 people. So, and I'm not even going to give the racial breakdowns.
I know the racial breakdown. It's 9 were Black Americans and 19 were white Americans. Am I right?
Yeah.
No, that's crucial. That's crucial.
It is crucial, but think of it from this perspective. So let's say we implement various changes, whatever they may be. According to these stats, there are still 41 people in 2019 that were killed. I don't think we're ever going to get, just like with school shootings, I don't think you would ever fully put a stop to prevent them from happening. Unfortunately, no. You're going to have issues like that. Same goes in this particular instance. We could do plenty of reforms that are going to be good for police departments, good for Black America, good for just Americans in general. But I don't think we're ever going to come to a point where we're going to completely prevent these from happening. And my concern is, what is the end objective? And I'm not sure of necessarily even the Black Lives Matter movement or what. We need to have a clear and defined objective. Because let's say we do all of these things and then we reduce these number of shootings from 41, let's say down to 20. And there's still a handful that may be minority in nature. Are we going to push for further change? Or are we just going to accept the reality of, listen, we've made improvements. These things are still going to happen. It's, I think, ultimately the hope of making sure there's no systemic racism in police departments across the country. But I think that's an important point that needs to be brought up. You know, we want action. We all agree we want action. We're all sick to our stomach of what happened to George Floyd, because I didn't even need to watch the whole video. I watched less than 30 seconds of it. It was sick to my stomach that what that police officer did. You know, no average person, no person would just do that and continue to do it and continue to do it and continue to do it for that period of time. It was sick to my stomach, and it was sick to the stomachs of virtually every American. But we have to be clear and understand that even if we make changes, these things can still happen. And it's an unfortunate thing, but we also are a country of, what, 320 million people?
325, yeah, 330.
And all I ask is that let's take the emotion out of it. I know there's plenty of emotions going around, but
yeah,
we have to be realistic about this and accept and acknowledge that these things could continue to happen in the future despite all of the changes. And my hope is that if they do happen after changes are made, we don't push for even further change, because you're never going to get to a pure zero here.
Yeah, that's a really good point. The law of statistics dictates that you'll eventually have anomalies, right? If you have a distribution pattern of any sort of natural phenomenon, there are going to be extremities, you know, and if you have 325 million people, some will die by the hands of the police unjustly. It's just inevitable, right? I think that that's a really good point to keep in mind. And, you know, I understand in the initial aftermath, you know, emotions flare high. People have been, as I said before, have been cooped up and emotions have flared high. So I get that. But this debate has gone far beyond that, right? And those numbers, if you cite them, people will say, well, you're not allowed to cite them, right? You're not allowed to have any sort of discussion of statistics or numbers in context or anything like that, because that's racism. You're just not. It's shut down. People want to shut down that portion of the debate. And, you know, I go back to this idea of, we've moved to a model of what I call resource liberalism, right? And resource liberalism basically assumes that all the problems of the world can be fixed with simply more resources. If you name the problem, teen pregnancy, drug addiction, alcohol abuse, murder, crime, wage inequality, wealth inequality, etc. Resource liberalism assumes that all these problems can be fixed by just reallocating resources, right? That's the operating assumption. And so when they say, well, let's defund the police, but we're going to reorient this money away from police into, you know, like sociologists or people on the ground for that. Well, the problem is America has largely tried that. If you look at spending from the 1960s to 2020, right, our spending has increased dramatically. It's skyrocketed. We're spending trillions more in social spending than we ever did before. And we're not seeing a lot of results for it. If you look at education spending, right, that was one of the arguments. I just read an argument that said, well, the reason why crime is so high in these areas is because instead of giving money to our schools, we're giving money towards police. And, you know, people aren't going to school. They're not learning. They're not getting all that money, and they're committing crime. Well, there's a simple problem with that. And the simple problem is that American school funding on a per capita basis has risen dramatically over the years. It's gone from around $2,000 controlling for inflation in 1950 to over $15,000 today. We're the second highest in the OECD of school funding. In some of the poorest areas in America, such as DC, they have some of the highest school funding. We tried an experiment in Newark, New Jersey, right? I think Mark Zuckerberg pledged like $100 million to the school system. And test scores didn't budge, right? The stuff didn't budge. So only somebody completely ignorant of the actual social policy that was implemented in America in the 60s and 70s could believe that like we're starving our public services, right? We've exploded our public services. It doesn't matter Republican or Democrat. They continue to rise in an absolute basis and on a per capita basis. And we still have these problems. And I want to say one more thing, and then I'll turn it over to you. I think there are bad police officers, right? I think there are racist police officers. But I still think that the police is fundamentally a good organization. And I wish people would stick up for it. Because does the police force in America need reform? Well, yeah, but it's local level. It depends on what locality we're talking about, right? And depends on what you want to do in terms of the reforms. But I believe that the average police officer and the majority of police officers are good and decent men and women. And people are unwilling to step up for them. And there's a silent majority of Americans who I think are aghast at all this, but they're afraid to speak out because they don't want to, you know, create social media battles, right? Like I did whenever I post anything. When I tried to get guests on here, I got some flack for it, right?
Just a little bit, right?
But the police are fundamentally good and decent people. And I want to make one other point. This might be controversial, but you know, the American police force is not monolithically white. There are Black people, there are Hispanic people that are police officers, and these are good people, right? And if you look at the crime rates from the 1980s and 1990s when it peaked, to the decline, thousands of Black lives have been saved because of vigilant policing efforts and disciplined policing efforts, etc. So the police are responsible for pacifying a lot of these areas and these neighborhoods, which were virtual war zones in the 1980s. I don't think we realize how bad crime was in the 70s and the 80s, okay? And this isn't a white on Black thing. This is a white, Black, Hispanic, all sort of Asian, whatever. Police officers were out there working to make these neighborhoods safe. Do some police officers make bad decisions? Yeah, totally. Right? In a split second, you could be a total angel, but in a split second, you make a bad decision and you have to live with it for the rest of your life. Right? That exists. I'm not saying that, but can we please stop trying to damn the entire police department in the United States? That's my opinion. I know it's controversial, right? But, you know, you look at all these little protests, the minute something goes wrong, right, they all scream, call the police, call the police. Hey, lefties, you want gun control? Who do you think's going to confiscate the guns, okay? It's not the hipster that weighs 110 pounds wearing, like, a flannel shirt with, like, a skinny beard. He's like, oh, I hate these rednecks. Let's confiscate the AR-15s. It's the police. They're doing your dirty work, right? You want gun control? You want all these other little progressive policies? It's the police that are going to have to do it. So, okay, I'll turn it over to you. I've been going on too much.
No, excellent points. So as I've been reflecting this past week on everything taking place, and ultimately what I think we all need to care a lot about is what solutions, what reforms can be put in place to help address this situation. And in terms of like the history of our country, one thing that kind of jumps out at me is back, I want to say it was early 2000, probably around 2002, was the sex abuse scandal in the Roman Catholic Church. And
one controversial topic to the other. If we're not talking about racism, let's talk about sex abuse in the Roman Catholic Church.
And I'm Catholic, so
yeah,
not that it matters, but I'm still going to comment on this.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Yeah, so I mean, it first kind of came out in early 2000s, and it's kind of continued up until, you know, recently. I know in the Catholic Diocese of Youngstown, they released a list of names of priests with credible accusations within, I think it was probably about a year and a half ago. And these accusations predate 2002. They go well back, 60s, 70s, even earlier than that. But ultimately, do we think as Americans that the Catholic Church is bad? No. Do some? Sure. I mean, there's some probably on the fringes or the extremes who take issue with the Catholic Church related to the sex abuse scandal, not necessarily with doctrine and all that. So we have a church that had people who you would expect to trust, people who are supposed to live in the image of God, or I'm not sure necessarily what you would say their exact role is, but to carry out the Catholic faith. And they abused it, whether it's with young boys or young girls or whomever, it doesn't matter. It was sick what they did. But reforms had to take place. And if you kind of look at the numbers, I mean, with how many credible accusations there were in the Catholic diocese, Youngstown and other dioceses, one could certainly make the argument that the number of bad priests is much higher than the number of bad cops in this country.
Yeah. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, like, in the Catholic Diocese of Youngstown, for instance, like, I previously coached soccer at a local Catholic school. Now I'm on the board of Urson High School, on the finance committee as well.
Wow.
We're required to go through a training course before we are allowed to sit on these organizations. So whether you're a teacher, a coach, a volunteer, like myself, you know, sit on a committee or on a board, we're required to go through a program. Granted, it's a one evening or, you know, a 2-3 hour program to help address and help us identify where sex abuse or sexual harassment, those types of things, might be taking place. So the Catholic Church responded to this and said, you know what, well, we could do nothing, or we could do something. And they chose to do this to help all of those around the priest or around anybody in control in a Catholic organization, whether it be in the church or a school or on a, you know, some sort of ministry of some sort, helps us kind of pick up on things that maybe would help address and catch somebody if it were to be happening. So they went through a program of reforms, and hopefully we'll see that those reforms pay dividends in the long run. Fast forward to now. So now we have an issue with the systemic racism. I don't say it's rampant in the police force at all, but there are elements of it where there are certain racist cops out there. So you have to put some sort of reforms together where I think it probably would be maybe a combination of trainings, probably not, you know, something that's probably more annual in nature, to like a system of reporting. I mean, it's easy for us when we're talking with our coworkers and around, you know, like the water cooler, as they like to say, to kind of be a little bit open, be a little bit free with our opinions. And I think there is where other cops might pick up on some things. And then obviously with social media, people are posting questionable things. It's going to be, like we said a few minutes ago, you're never going to completely eliminate it. But if you do these sorts of reforms, and I'm sure there's plenty more, which I'm hoping some people comment on and share their thoughts. The hope is that you can alleviate and get these bad cops out in some facet or another. And I guess those are my original thoughts. It's a tough thing to consider what kind of reforms are realistic, but needs to be done.
Yeah, but like, okay. So the problem with that is, so first of all, you know, one of the big things that's changed is that it's not that I don't necessarily think there are more bad actors, right? I think it's just maybe that there's more media attention, especially with social media, that the bad actors that do exist are more publicized, right? Like, we've seen confidence in our institutions, everything from the church, the government, to the police, fall off dramatically. And the reason is, I think, largely because there's more media access to things. Like, people are more aware of things. It's not necessarily that the incidents rates have increased. Maybe they have, maybe they haven't. But it's just the awareness of the incidents that do occur is wider. The idea of, like, going to a class and unlearning racism, I don't know. Like, it's like, do you really need to go to a class to learn not to molest people? I don't think that was what changed the Catholic Church. I think they got sued. And they got, you know, they saw their property portfolio, they had to liquidate. And that's what kind of forced them into better behavior that we know of, right? And let's be honest, the Catholic Church didn't really have that best reaction to the priest molestation. They just kind of moved priests around for a while until people got really bad. And I also think that's why the Catholic Church is so pro-open borders, because, you know, the base of Catholics in America that were loyal to the Catholic Church, you know, the Catholic Church, many of the priests, not all of them, not even the majority, but some of them molested the sons and daughters of these loyal people. And then they stopped going to church and they said, oh, our pews are empty. Well, now all of a sudden it's a moral imperative to have open borders and to let Hispanics into the United States. You know, it's like, oh, well, that seems a little coincidental with, you know, the loss, you know, your loss of your base. Now all of a sudden you're for open borders and open immigration. Total another issue, right? But with the police, you know, the fact is, it's such a tough thing, right? Because I'm like the most vanilla dude out there, right? Let's be honest, okay? I'm wearing pink shorts, for example. But the police, I think overall do a fundamentally decent job. See, here's the thing. Do you view them from the standard of they must be perfect or that they should aim towards perfection, right? And you know that they won't be perfect, but as long as they're trying to continually aim towards perfection, what sort of standard do you judge them on? And you know, anytime there's a case of police brutality or the police kill somebody that they shouldn't kill, absolutely, they should face the full force of the law because it discredits the American police force. But the idea that we can reform our way out of it when there were nine you know, there were like 40 total deaths in the United States of unarmed people out of a nation of 330 million. This goes back to your earlier point. Statistics dictate no matter what you do, there's going to be these events at the margin. They're not good, right? And we got to do all we can to stop them. But I just don't know how much society can actually do at the end of the day. To your point earlier, I don't know how much we can really achieve. I mean, if we're being honest with ourselves and we're being very brutally realistic and honest, you know, can we make that number go to zero? I don't know if we ever can. Should it go to zero? Yes. Should we aim for that? Yes. But can we actually achieve that? It's doubtful, right? And it has nothing to do with racism. It's just, I think, the fact that people, you know, police are constantly in a high-stress position on the front lines, and they make bad decisions. And so, then there are racist police officers out there, but, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, no, and I think maybe some pushback to that would be from some is it's not necessarily all about the number of deaths, which you could certainly make that argument. And I think what's going to be really key moving forward is strengthening the relationship between police departments and urban communities.
Yeah.
In Black America. And I think some cities across the country, they probably do an excellent job with this. I mean, I think anecdotally, locally in Youngstown, I think it seems as though there is a good relationship between the Black community and the police department. And, you know, it helps, you know, we have a Black mayor, Mayor Tito Brown. You know, they had a protest Sunday, I think it was. I mean, by all accounts, it was a peaceful protest, which is great. And I do want to hit this point home because we haven't mentioned it yet. I think I'm happy to see, and I'm all about our rights and the freedom to protest. And I'm happy people are exercising those rights. And I think we'll talk maybe in a few minutes about maybe those who are taking it too far, or more of those, the anarchists, the Antifa types who are trying to really drive a wedge in the things. But, you know, I want to commend those who are doing that. And it's a freedom of our country, and it's a way for people to express themselves. And I think it's important. And like I said, the one in Youngstown went well. And I think that is in part because of that relationship between the police force and the city. So I think ultimately a lot of these police departments are going to have to find a way to do better outreach, to develop elements of trust, go into churches, go into Boys and Girls Clubs across urban communities, find ways to really build elements of trust. And it's going to start with the youth. If you really want to build up an element of trust, you have to build it up, I think, at a younger age.
Yeah.
Develop that relationship now so it builds forth moving forward. If you wait too long and just say, like, wait till after kids are out of high school or college, I think that's a little too late. So I think it's critical that they build these relationships earlier rather than later.
So, okay, a couple points. I think that's all well and good. I think that's absolutely true. But I think the majority of Americans actually like and support their local police department. Right.
Oh, I agree.
It's like Americans say, I don't like Congress, but I like my congressman or my congresswoman. Right. I think a lot of people say, yeah, the police have problems, but my local police department are fundamentally good guys. I think there was a poll by Morning Consult that showed like 80 to 85% of Americans support their local police department. I think police do this by and large. Like, I think the police are more active and they're more engaged in their communities. I want to make another point though, and this kind of goes to the riots and stuff. The people that have turned against the police and the people that are leading these protests, right? It's a community. Oh, sorry, we had a technical thing. You think it would be the Black communities, right? But I actually think, and this is just my gut, I could be completely off base by this. I think that the middle and the working class Black communities are largely supportive of the police force and were largely opposed to the rioters. Not necessarily protesters, right? Not the people peacefully protesting, but the people rioting, burning down on the streets. I think this is a class divide. I saw a video of a woman, a Black woman, who was lamenting the fact that her store, it was like a shop, had been burned down. She's like, this is where I work. Who's going to pay for it to be rebuilt or anything like that? What I see happening is this is a elite-driven phenomenon. This is a highly educated, there are college kids that are upper middle class, a lot of them white kids, but like doctors, lawyers, kids that went for like all sorts of like, you know, white collar jobs, marketing that. These are the ones that are really into this movement. These are the ones that are really leading the more radical protests and the radical change. And I think it reminds me, again, I have to go back to 19th century Russia, where the elites in Russia no longer had faith in the Tsarist system and they wanted to see it overthrown. And they were into this millenarianism, a religious impulse called Marxism, which saw an imminent overthrow of the world order and a new utopian communist paradise about to be implemented. I think if you look at a lot of the people who are the protesting, a lot of them are upper middle class white kids. I mean, let's put it out there, right? It's like white girls taking photos for their Instagram account. Like, look at me protest, right? It's not like a 45-year-old Black guy. It's like a security guard somewhere, you know, he's a working class Joe. He's not the one leading this protest. A lot of it are bourgeois white kids. I don't know how else to put this, right? Like, it's mind-boggling. And I'm not trying to say that there aren't other groups attached to this, but these are the ones leading the charge. So to me, this isn't really about the police at the end of the day. This is a more radical left-wing movement that's trying to overthrow America because they've been taught this anti-American ideology from the womb, and they probably feel guilty because their parents were wealthy and now they're wealthy and they've done nothing to deserve it, and they're, you know, they don't have working class parents or middle class parents, and so they feel guilt and they blame all their problems on themselves, and they want this absolution that comes from acknowledging their white privilege and kneeling before Black people. You know, it's interesting too, can I make this other observation? The whole white privilege thing, it takes all the moral agency out of Black people. And it exclusively assigns moral agency to white people. And by that, it means white people have to make the conscious choice of acknowledging their white privilege in order to achieve some form of absolution. But Black people they're the oppressed. They're not called to do anything because they're the oppressed. They're the victim group, right? So it completely takes away moral agency from Black or brown people, and it gives it all to the white people. So I'm watching these movements where you have these masses of white people who are raising their hands and they're renouncing their white privilege, and then they're kneeling. And I'm thinking to myself, this is a religious movement, and it's a very bizarrely white supremacist religious movement because it gives them all the power and the authority, even though they're like the guilty privileged one. But do you see what I'm saying? Like, through a weird inverse of agency, it gives them all the moral agency, right? Does that make sense?
It makes sense.
We got a message from Mackenzie Metzinger.
This is my cousin Mackenzie. She's a fellow accountant.
It's more about the deaths. Yes, that's the most crucial aspect of the movement, but it's about being able to drive through Poland Canfield as a person of color without being pulled over for going 26 miles per hour. So having more Black teachers, professors, and counselors, et cetera. From our perspective, and I include myself with you both, how can we say that we think the Black community members feel like they have a good relationship with police officers? Well, that's what survey data shows. Because my friends of color do not agree with that. Well, that's anecdotes. I'm sorry your friends don't agree with that. And how can we say that we think most officers do a great job? I know for me, my interaction with the police consists of getting pulled over a lot off, even though I was speeding. Well, you shouldn't speed. That's on you. We not
in her defense, she does live in Poland where they do pull you over.
Well, why do you live in this community? That would be my question to you. Why am I responsible for you living in, if Poland's this racist community, why don't you move? Mackenzie Metzinger, nobody's forcing you to live there. Why don't you move to Youngstown or move to Warren or Farrell or even the less cool Austin town? Why don't you move?
She's actually she's in Columbus now, I think.
Oh, okay. What are the demographics of where you live in Columbus?
That I'm not going to. Yeah, she works at a CPA firm. Well, no, I get your point.
My point is, if these areas are so bad, right? These are so horrible. So here's the other thing that's going on, right? When we see these incidents of police brutality, they're largely confined to urban areas that have been ruled by Democrats and leftists and liberals for decades, if not centuries, right? Like your conservative Dane Davis, right, does not have any insight into the governance of Cleveland, Ohio, or New York City, or of, you know, downtown Columbus, or of Chicago. Like the Republican Party isn't really a strong political force in Chicago. Or this might be a shocker to some people, but I don't know if people are aware, but the Republican Party is not really strong in the city of Minneapolis or even in the state of Minnesota. I think in Ronald Reagan's reelection campaign, Minnesota was like the only state that voted blue. Okay,
Trump only lost it by 1.5 points.
Yeah, it's changing. So Democrats, look at yourself. See, this is the thing. This is the magic of this like white privilege movement. Because all of a sudden it's not like, hey, maybe Democrats should govern cities better and maybe liberal politicians should govern cities better. And hey, what about the mayor and city council of the city of Minneapolis? What are you guys doing, right? No. It's like, it's all white people, right? Some farmer that lives in like, you know, rural Minnesota is automatically has the same amount of guilt as some bourgeois liberal politician in Minnesota or Minneapolis, right? That's the magic of this ideology. If it's everybody's guilt, it's nobody's guilt. And then there's no accountability, right? So, you know, Chicago, there are tens of hundreds of people dying in Chicago, like every year, thousands die in Chicago every year. But if you turn it to a discussion of white privilege, all of a sudden it's like it's not the city leaders of Chicago's fault anymore. It's not the community's fault. It's like all white people of the state of Illinois, right? Like some random white dude in the corner of Nebraska has no influence or no control over some police officer shooting somebody in Chicago. It just there's no connection there, right? Like there's none. Explain that to me. Explain what metaphysical force unites Farmer Joe in the corner of the panhandle of Nebraska and the police officers in Chicago. You know, like, are we going to have this conversation? Well, okay, Democrats, you have the conversation first. You fix your problem because you're in control of these cities. You there?
No, I'm sorry.
I didn't mean to be mean to Mackenzie Metzinger. Mackenzie, I'm sorry. I'm not trying to be mean.
So I guess this is a kind of good segue into a point I really did want to hit home. And we'll kind of tie this in with a few of your points you just made. But it's this idea of the importance of voting. What I find fascinating is the...
Oh, you froze. Oh, Michael, I think it froze.
So all the people watching. Wait. We seem to have lost Dane and
I'm back. Can you hear me? I'm back.
All right. That's fine. So the point this is kind of a time for a good segue into my belief why it's so important to vote. What I find fascinating is the number of people who've been posting so much stuff on social media. And you ask yourself, well, you know, are they in the process or not? I mean, what people need to realize, voting information, not necessarily who you vote for, but the voting rules are public information. So like I could see like if Dane Davis is a registered voter or not. And I could also see like, especially in Mahoning County, I could see if Michael Metzinger, A, is registered to vote and B, did he vote? So I'm not saying I looked it up a couple of people who just said who aren't even registered to vote or are registered to vote and hardly ever vote. But that kind of hits home to the point you're trying to make here. So Let's talk Minneapolis.
Yeah, Minneapolis. Talk Minneapolis.
And I want to hear.
Wait, pause. Have you been to Minneapolis?
I've never been to Minnesota.
I've been to Minnesota multiple times, actually, for business. It's a weird place.
What were you, Minneapolis or St. Paul?
I was in Minneapolis. I was in St. Cloud. I was in Fergus Falls. I was all throughout there. And then I've been there a couple times. I've been like four or five times in my life. I've driven through it too. So go ahead. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No. So let's use this in the context of, because I do eventually want to tie this into Donald Trump. So a lot of the posts that I'm seeing on social media are stating like, oh, Donald Trump's a racist, or other ones are like, oh, we need to get Donald Trump out so this stuff doesn't happen anymore. And we'll hit home those points in a couple minutes. But the important point here to note, especially let's say Minneapolis, is because this is relevant. Mayor, young guy, I think he's a Democrat, regardless of.
No, he is a Democrat. He's not. Jacob Frey, I think, is the mayor, and he's most certainly a Democrat. Yeah.
Okay. And I saw he got the protest yesterday. They shoot him out of there. They weren't happy with what he had to say. But we hear so much about Trump. And we'll talk about Trump in a minute. Would voting out Trump change the fact that that cop should not have been in office or not have had that job? No. Who's responsible for that cop having that job? Especially if what some people are stating, that this guy has had a checkered history in the past. Is it Donald Trump? No, he has nothing to do with that. Is it the mayor of Minneapolis? Well, we're getting closer, but indirectly, yes, but no. Who really has a say in the human resources and job decisions of a police department, the police chief or police commissioner, whomever? Well, unless I'm not aware of this, I'd say virtually every police commissioner, police chief across the country is appointed by a mayor. I mentioned this because we're going to hear all this talk over the next 5 months on the importance of voting in this presidential election, especially with Trump and people wanting to accuse Trump of everything. But really, if people really want to make change, and they really want to have an impact on your local communities, it's these local elections that really dictate things. So in like Minneapolis, for instance.
I just want to pause. The police chief in Minneapolis is a man by the name of Medaria Arredondo, which sounds Hispanic, but he's actually an African-American and the first Black person who serves the chief of the Minneapolis Police Department. So keep going. Sorry. They're interesting facts.
And again, that's a very large city. It's a major city in the Midwest, upper Midwest. He probably has a department of hundreds upon hundreds of people. So the idea of him actually knowing of this person and his checkered history, probably not there. But again, right. My point is Trump has nothing to do with this. It's the local elections that matter. If you have if people in different parts of the country, whether it's Minneapolis or Columbus or Cleveland or Pittsburgh, if there's issues with community, like relations between Black America and Black residents in those cities, in the police department, it's not Donald Trump's fault. It's not Barack Obama's fault. It's not Joe Biden's fault. It's nobody's fault at the federal level. These are local issues. And if there's systemic issues on a local level, you need to be voting you should be getting involved in the local elections, asking questions and voting. And far too many people just ignore. First off, far too many people aren't registered to vote, one. Second, people who are registered to vote, very few of them vote outside of presidential elections. That's two. And three, why do people not vote in local elections? If anything, like your vote as a percentage of the votes cast in a local election, your vote, I guess, has a greater value than it does at the presidential level. But in all these major cities that we cited, and many of which, probably most, but not all, but many of which are run by Democrats.
No, they're all.
With the exception of like a San Diego, I think.
San Diego, yeah.
Yeah, and a few others. But by and large, most of them are. So these are issues where these mayors should be making sure that they have police chiefs in place.
But in all these major cities.
I heard myself there.
Sorry about that.
So the police chiefs or the mayors need to be the ones having police chiefs holding their departments accountable. So I really wanted to hit home that aspect. it's so we're going to hear a lot about voting for the next 5 months, because a lot of people, some are viewing this as a tool to remove Trump from office. But as a reminder, 4 years ago, this movement, Black Lives Matter movement, was also taking place. I believe Ferguson happened in 2016.
2014.
Didn't necessarily materialize in terms of defeating Trump. And if anything, you know, let's say like Michigan, for instance, a state that Hillary Clinton honestly thought she had won, and she had horrible turnout, especially in like in a Wayne County. But back to my original point, people, if you're listening, regardless of where you are at on the political spectrum, I hope you now have a better understanding of why we have this podcast, to have this discussion, but B, have a better idea of the importance of voting. We all need to do a better job of informing ourselves of the candidates, of the issues, and asking questions. These Black Lives Matter protests, or protests in general across the country, so many of them seem to be targeted at Washington.
Yeah.
But they should be targeted at local governments, I think.
But here's the thing. What you said, everything you said, Michael, was 100% the truth. That ultimately, in the democracy that we have, the most influence you have is on a local level, on a city or an county level. You have a lot of influence. People have a lot more influence than they realize. Everything you said is true. And everything you also – you made a good point about the accountability. The buck stops at the local level, right? You can pick, you know, the Dalai Lama to be the president or Mohammed Gandhi, and you're still going to have police brutality in the United States, because the president, at the end of the day, really doesn't matter, only at the margins, right? Because it's such a big, 325 million people that it's just the scale is too great to really make an impact on the local level. So everything you just said is true. And I agree with it, but here's the thing, right? You're trying to understand this through, and I think you understand it better than that. But if you view this through simply the prism of people are mad and they want a political change, that's the wrong prism to take. You have to view this through, this is the emergence of a new religion for the elite, right? They don't want solutions. They don't want, listen, the Democrats have, if voting blue were the solution to police brutality, then we wouldn't be hearing about police brutality, because all these incidents are in blue areas that have been blue for decades, right? Detroit, Chicago, Minneapolis, New York City, etc. These are all blue metropolitan areas, okay? If it were simply a matter of funding, you know, the worst crime area. It should be like backwater West Virginia. They have some of the worst social funding out there. Okay. You have to look at the reality and say, hey, maybe these catchy one-liners don't make sense. But going back to what I was saying, the reason why people are protesting, one, I think it's a lot of, overweight single women who are trying to post something for their Instagram profile. Like, don't discount the role of the cat lady syndrome. And the cat lady syndrome are people that would normally be creating or starting families, or they're 35-year-old millennials making PowerPoints, and they have nothing else to do with their life, right? They would be busy with kids, and now they have nothing to do. So they're going to join every social cause, right? That's driving this. You know, people were cooped up inside. That's driving this. You've got guys. Guys are they're thirsty, right? They're trying to, let me put it diplomatically, they're trying to hook up with ladies. They're pretending to care. Whatever the latest social movement is, they're like, oh, hey, you're really into this, putting a black thing on your Instagram, a black profile picture. Oh, I'll do it too. Can we go on a date? I'm really into social justice. Is that what you're into? I'm into that too. Let's go on a date. Like, the majority of people don't actually care, because if they cared, they would do the hard things like go to township trustee meetings, or vote for local elections, or write to your local newspaper, or, go to the local city hall, and all the town council meetings are public. Okay. It takes an hour out of your day. It's boring. Go to that. Talk to your city councilman or councilwoman, run for office if you want to. People don't want to do that though. They want to be seen as, this is all about public status, and I want to be seen as I care, and I'm going to post the Instagram profile pic. Not everybody, right? I think people do genuinely care, but that's a lot of what's motivating this is this social media. I can show my virtue by doing these really cheap things that don't cost me any time or effort. So you're absolutely right. But there's a reason why people don't do that. It's because they're lazy.
And Great points. I do want to make another point, though.
Yeah.
That I've been seeing a lot of, and it's some other, not movement, but a theme that I've seen in on people's social media is this idea of we need to vote in Joe Biden. Let's take a step back here. Yes, Joe Biden.
You know, here's the thing. Wait, I got to pause.
Go ahead.
Heard that Joe Biden has the solution to racism. He just forgot about it. Right? How screwed are we? Like, Joe Biden, no. He's 78 years old. He found the cure for racism. You know, being in office since the 70s, he found the cure. And he was about to tell us, but then he forgot. I've heard that. I don't know. Is that true, Michael?
I mean, it might be. It might be true.
Sorry.
No. You're good. So let's go back. Previous administration, first African American president. And these same things happened during the Obama administration. Baltimore, Ferguson. I mean, my wife and I had gone on a little trip to D.C. I think it was right after the 4th of July in 2016. Right after Ferguson happened, and we were on a night tour of the city, and we went right through a protest. So these things happened under the previous administration. What did they do? I went through President Obama's speeches. I didn't see a single his addresses to the country, whether it's a primetime address or other types of addresses. I did not see one on this particular issue. But we had the looting, we had the rioting, we had the peaceful protests in various spots. But to me, if there was somebody who would have been great, whether I don't agree with him on a political level, but I think who would have connected with some, especially those in the African-American community, because he's African-American, it would have been President Obama. And it didn't seem to me as though much race relations improved under him. And I think maybe in some argument, some could argue that they actually maybe were damaged in some ways, because these types of things I don't think happen at the rate that they're happening now. So that's one aspect. But the vice president of the United States, the number two guy in our country during that administration, was Joe Biden. Joe Biden was a U.S. senator from, let's see, 1973 to 2009, okay? So he had 8 years as vice president, 36 years as a U.S. senator. What solutions has Joe Biden had for this? What? I mean, seriously, people. Like, it's one thing if we have a change candidate, like, let's say Mayor Pete. I'm just throwing him out there. He's a core example, but he's somebody, you know, new on the scene, doesn't have a huge record behind him. Joe Biden has 40-plus years behind him, folks. What has he done to improve? Is it simply like, is it A, you just want to remove Trump? And or B, do you really think Biden has the answers? Because if we're looking at things factually based on his record, I'd say no, he doesn't have the answers. But there's this push that we need to vote in Biden. But you know, I refrain for the most part on social media from getting in bickering.
That's not as far as you are, but yes, go ahead. Yeah,
I don't like the turmoil. If I don't have to deal with it, I have enough headaches in other aspects, you know, getting things done for work or different things like that, and I don't want to deal with it. But you know, I have from the MVRed Twitter account. If you don't follow us, MVRed Podcast on Twitter, and also on Facebook, at us, like us on there. I've commented on some people's tweets asking them that very point, and I just get silenced. And I've been trying to hit some of these people with the same points over and over again, and I continue to get silence. It seems as though, A, they don't want to respond to me, or B, they don't have an answer. But there really isn't an answer. I mean, if under the Obama administration, let's say there's a big task force, and Biden led the task force, and he had all these various proposals that may or may not have passed, that's one thing. But what did he do for Black America, especially as it relates to what we're seeing with this idea of systemic racism in police departments? My argument is nothing. So I do push back on this notion that if we vote out Trump and get in Biden, things are going to be better. They're not going to get any better.
No, I mean, no, they're not. No.
I needed to air that grievance. It's like Festivus in June. I it's something that's been grinding my gears. And hopefully, you know, I know we have people from looking on Facebook that I know are of the left, lean left, who disagree with us on political things. I'm hoping they're still on and they could comment on that various point. Like, what is it about Joe Biden that makes you think things are going to improve? Is it just because he's not Trump? And is that really a good reason to vote for Biden?
No.
If this is the big issue of the election.
So let me go one level deeper. What you just said, it's everything you just said is 100% on the mark, right? What is Biden going to do? But there's a bigger question here. What is liberalism going to do? Liberalism as a political force, again, assumes that if we just redistribute resources, all of our problems will be solved. But America has basically engaged in liberal policy since the 1960s, right? We had a complete repudiation of the pre-New Deal order with the defeat of Barry Goldwater at the hands of Lyndon Baines Johnson in 1964. So the current view of, well, you know, sorry, my wife just walked in the room and broke my train of thought. So this view of, but here's the thing, like you said, what's Joe Biden going to do? What is liberalism going to do? Liberalism as an ideology, as a political force, has had a complete monopoly on the cities and on the urban areas in America. Okay, Chicago, if liberalism was an effective political force that could solve these issues of police brutality, Chicago should be a racial paradise, right? And it's one of the most divided, segregated areas. So the failures of liberalism never get ascribed to liberalism. Okay, it's constantly redirected elsewhere. We didn't have enough funding. Funding's gone up. It's those, you know, those people in the suburb. Okay, it's those people in the farms. It's white privilege, whatever. But never does the buck stop with the people in power. So my question is, what policy? Everything you just described, like let's give people classes, right? Let's teach them not to be racist. Let's give people body cameras and that. I'm going to tell you right now, it's not going to solve the fundamental issue. It's not going to change the problem, right? Because this is just, you know, the same sort of resource liberalism. Let's just give people more money. It's going to solve the problem. And the problem is we've done that as a society. We've really tried that. You know, here's the thing in America we don't like to talk about as a society. And the thing in America is that, like, you know, we all celebrate multiculturalism. And that's one of these, like, ideological values, which we are not allowed to question at all. You can't say you're against multiculturalism. But, you know, with different cultures come different beliefs and potentially different outcomes. You know, maybe there's something there. If you have a multicultural society, you're inherently going to have an unequal society. You're going to have a society with differences in terms of wealth, in terms of achievement, in terms, because the cultures are different. Maybe certain cultures do better in a technological society than that. I don't know. I honestly don't know. These are interesting questions, but we can't answer those. Instead, the debate is always confined to this idea of we need to spend more money. And I think that's what Joe Biden represents. And to your point, what is Joe Biden going to do? Joe Biden is a symbol of a broader question of what is liberalism going to do? Okay. What is it going to do that it couldn't have already done? Right. Is liberalism really going to cure racism? It's going to intensify the efforts. And we're going to continue to see these Maoist struggle sessions where people admit their white privilege and, you know, in mass, and they raise their hands in that, because as the liberalism was inherently an empirical ideology. We just give more money, X amount of dollars, we could have Y outcome. When that starts to break down, people move back into something quasi-religious, which is the movement we're seeing now. And that moves into, you know, all what we're seeing on our political landscape. To your point, to kind of make a full circle of this podcast, you said, I wish people would learn to disagree and to reason with each other and to love your enemy, right? Well, it's hard to do that when you're following a different religion, when you have a fundamentally different worldview. And that's what's coming. There is no longer a united America. You know, we always say, well, you know, we're a country that's united on our principles, but rarely do we ask the follow-up question, exactly what principles are those? Because I think we're deeply afraid of the answer. And the answer is we don't have any principles that unify us anymore. This is not the country of the 50s and the 60s. This is fundamentally a different country that is no longer unified. Boomers cannot understand this point at all. This is just like shock to them, right? They think that they can just roll back the clock. No, the clock has been permanently moved forward. You know, this idea of the country's changed. And the America that we grew up in is dying. And I hope the left is happy, because you're not going to like what comes next, The America of yesteryear had its problems and it was a flawed country, but it was a fundamentally good and decent country. And, you know, you think you Jacobins, you think you can create a new paradise on earth, a new utopia. You're not. You're only going to bring down hell upon all of us. And you're going to find out eventually. We're not going into a good direction. Elect Joe Biden all you want. He's senile. Okay. A senile 78-year-old is not going to fundamentally fix the problems. And if you think that, you're either delusional or dumb or ignorant, or you just want a Democrat in office, which just say so. You want a Democrat in office. Okay. But let's not pretend that Joe Biden is going to fix it. Sorry, that was a little too spicy. I'll turn it over back to you, Michael.
I don't mind the spice. Before we wrap this episode up, and because I do want to touch on my thoughts on Trump and his handling of the crisis. As it relates to this whole movement, part of me thinks there are definitely a large number of people who believe in it for the issues that it's presenting. But I believe there is also a I don't know if it's substantial, but there are, I believe, a group of people who believe this is a means to help Biden in 2020. Maybe not even help Biden to defeat Trump because of the enthusiasm gap with Biden. The youth are not enthusiastic about voting for Joe Biden. They are not. They were big on Bernie Sanders. They were big on Elizabeth Warren. Joe Biden was their last choice in many cases. So I think some are latching onto this as the movement to get through to November, that winning movement to drive the voters home, the voters that essentially cost Hillary Clinton in the last election. I'm sure there are probably, you know, I think Hillary may have lost the state of Michigan by like 40,000 votes, something like that. I'm sure there are 40,000.
What's 16,
that? Okay, maybe I'm getting some of these states confused. 16,000 votes. I can assure you there are 16,000 people right now who did not vote in the last election, who don't like Donald Trump, that are probably on board with this movement, that if they vote or if they would have voted, she would have won that state. So I want to make that point because I don't think many people are enthusiastic about Biden, but this is a movement. This is that thing that could drive people to the polls in November. The only thing I'd push back to that as it's 5 months, and 5 months are an eternity in politics, which moves me to my next point, which is Trump's handling of this crisis. And I viewed this past 10 days as like his Access Hollywood moment of 2016, where I've just been frustrated with everything I'm seeing out of the White House, the lack of leadership in many respects. And just there's so much turmoil in our country right now. And you're just looking for somebody to say, do something. You know, who can we turn to in a time of crisis in our country to help alleviate maybe some of the angst, some of the emotions out of it? And I've taken issue with Trump in that respect, and it's been a tough 10-day stretch up until probably the jobs report on Friday. And I'll take it a step further that I think this has probably been his worst moment of his presidency. We've talked about his odds in November in this election and our overall thoughts. And I've been pretty steady that I felt he was going to win, or he had better than 50-50 odds. And I think, Dane, in many respects, up until maybe recently with the coronavirus, you would agree with that. But this is a moment where the economy, for the most part, has been in the tank because of coronavirus. And the coverage hasn't been great with that, but he's done an okay job, I guess, with that. Then this happened, and his initial response, I thought, was good. You know, condemning the attacks and, you know, we're going to get the Justice Department involved. And then it kind of just seemed like a tailspin once the riots and the looting happened, and it happened another night and it happened another night. It's like, is he ever going to respond, or is he going to keep tweeting about Joe Scarborough in this conspiracy theory? It just seemed like in my eyes, and maybe I'm blinded by my 2016 feelings of Trump here, but in my eyes that he lost sight of he was out of touch with what was happening, although he shouldn't have been, with it happening right outside of his window. So I think it's been a rough 10-day stretch, but there's time to recover, like we saw in 2016. Like I said, Access Hollywood 3 weeks before the election, I didn't even want to vote for him. I eventually did, but I didn't want to vote for him. The polls show that he was going to be – he was down 12, 14 points nationally, just like the polls are showing now. And, you know, I see these pundits saying, oh, this is going to be a wave election for the Democrats. Well, really? Because if we go back to 2016, that happened 3 weeks before the election, and he still won the election. So there's time for him to recover, but I think this has been a tough week for him. And before I hand it off to you, Dane, with a point here, there was an NBC Wall Street Journal poll out today where if you go issue by issue, Biden versus Trump, Trump is beating Biden on virtually every single issue or neck and neck with him. Where he gets destroyed is this idea of who on the issue of who can bring the country together, and it is Biden 51, Trump 26. Everything else, Trump is either beating or neck and neck. I can believe this poll because it seems as though there was a lack of, we could say lack of leadership, lack of whatever, but there wasn't much to unify the country out of the White House in this last week, in my it's not that anything Trump would have said was going to necessarily unify, but you're the president. Your actions do matter. And I think saying something does matter. But it's my hope that this week doesn't dictate his results in this election. I do fear it in some respects, but I also go back on this fact that we're 5 months away from the election. So I know that's a lot to handle, but I have been disappointed in talking and texting with some other diehard Trump supporters. I know that over the past week, they kind of felt the same way. And I think the jobs report has helped him, but he needs to still get through this stage and get through COVID and get in a campaign mode where I think he can do well.
I agree. I agree with everything you said. I think it makes sense. I think his problem was he facilitates, you know, the idea of Trump as this fascist is really not Trump is like an ADD type president or ADHD, or I don't mean that in an offensive way. Maybe I should put it less offensive way. Trump has a really poor follow through, right? And he facilitates between, you know, one extreme to the other. So he went from like, you know, don't send in the troops, you know, stand back, let these cities burn, right? And they burned over the weekend. And then all of a sudden it's like send in the military and start shooting people. And the problem with that is you alienate both sides, right? You alienate the peaceniks because you have the really horrible rhetoric. And then you alienate the hawks because you wait to take action. You dilly-dally. So I think that's his big problem, right? He hasn't taken decisive action. And I think if you look within the administration, the root of that is Jared Kushner. There's reporting by this guy named Brian Jerdewski. He's a really cool guy. You should follow him on Twitter. He's a nice kid. But he was basically, his sources were telling him that Kushner, you know, was afraid to alienate black voters by coming down strong against the rioters, when I actually think it's the opposite. People of all colors, you know, especially of working class, middle class people, respect a law and order type message against not the protesters, but the rioters, people destroying violence, and people conducting violence and destroying property. So I think that's why Trump saw a lot of his support level off. And, you know, Trump is not going to unify the nation. The nation can't be unified, I don't think. I think it's permanently split in two. People need to recognize that. We need to grow up about that, that there's no unification, right? But Trump can win when you shift the terms of the debate. If the key question of 2020 is who can unify, Trump will lose. There's no way you can move the polling on that, right? You have to change the question of who can have the economy recover the strongest, or who's the best in terms of bringing jobs back home, or who's the best in terms of foreign policy, or et cetera. Because I do agree. I think he lost a lot of capital during this. I think he was worse than coronavirus. I think he was the worst leadership of his presidency. And it's not because of anything he did in particular, but it was more, again, the rhetoric coming out of the White House and the lack of a strong vision and will either way. You either send in the troops or you don't. You don't threaten to send in the troops, right? It just looks weak. You crack down on these people, or you don't. You let them burn down the place, but you don't talk about cracking down on them while they're burning down the building. You just look like a fool in that case. I think he got a little bit of his mojo back when he did the photo op where they cleared out the area and then he walked in front of the church and held up the Bible. Twitter hated it, but I think ordinary people liked it. So I think he started to turn the narrative there. The riots have died down, so that's helping him. And the economy's starting to come back, so that's helping him. So I think he's at a low point. I expect him to recover as we go into the fall. But I think everything he said was right. I find much to just I can't find much to disagree with.
Yeah, I think ultimately it comes down to maybe independents and soft Republicans. Republicans who like Trump's policies, that don't like his personality, which I think there's a lot of them out there who this past week really softened to the idea of like, do I really want to deal with another 4 years of this if it's going to be complete and utter turmoil in the streets of our country and in social media and all that? I was just disappointed and I expected more from him. And it wasn't anything that was, this isn't like super difficult. Like, I'm not saying like, I agree, he's not going to unify the country, but like come out with a message and be like, listen, we need to stop the looting and the rioting because people who have every right to protest for the right reasons are getting a bad light. We've completely forgot this whole idea of George Floyd getting killed. We're talking about people throwing bricks through a wall and lighting things on fire, and we're not talking about the real issues of the day. This is why point A, point B, point C, this is why we need to do these things to stop this. I don't think it was a very difficult message to get through, but it was just mismanaged beyond belief. I put some of it on Trump. I put a lot of it around the people. I do – the buck stops with Trump.
Yeah.
And one thing is he surrounds himself with these people.
Yes.
They're his people, and they're the ones letting him down there.
Yeah.
And I think hopefully he gave it to them this past week. But I do think part of it does go back on him. Sometimes, you know, he tweets things. It's just like this whole Morning Joe thing and Joe Scarborough. It's like, why? Like, regardless, like, I don't get it. I'll never I'll never understand Trump. I'll never understand his personality.
He's a weird dude. I agree.
He is. And I don't vote for the guy, or I won't vote for him because of the personality or necessarily because I like his tweets. It's not that. It's just, it's nice seeing the economy doing well. It's nice to see justices that are nominated to the Supreme Court and us, the right side, him nominating a lot of judges through the federal judicial system. That's why I vote for him. It's not because of this aspect of
But you know, Michael, you know, let me stop you right there. Okay, Democrats, they knew Bill Clinton was a rapist. Okay, that's not new news. They knew he sexually abused women, right? But they voted for him because they wanted to keep abortion legal. Okay, so Republicans are the ones that beat themselves up about this kind of stuff. Democrats don't give a flying F. Okay, do you think Chris Dodd was a good guy? Look up Chris Dodd. People look up the Vanity Fair article about Chris Dodd. Do you think Ted Kennedy was a good guy? Ted Kennedy, I say this all the time, and I sound like a broken record. He murdered a woman and nobody cared. Okay, Mary Jo Kopechnik, right? He murdered her. Nobody cared. Nobody cared. Ted Kennedy, he's a Kennedy. They're good looking. They're Irish. Oh my gosh, they're so attractive. Nobody cared, right? Democrats voted for him. They voted for him numerous times, right? Who else do we got in the pantheon, right? Ralph Northam wore blackface, okay? Nobody cared. Kamala Harris. Kamala's a cop. She threw people in jail all the time. Nobody cares. She got elected. Nobody cared. Nobody cared. Bill de Blasio. He's an incompetent idiot. He doesn't. He gets reelected and reelected. Andrew Cuomo killed grandma. Andrew Cuomo sent all the coronavirus infected people into the nursing homes. He killed your grandma. He talks about meatballs, but he's killing grandma. Nobody cares. They don't care. So with all these personal feelings, like, oh, Trump, he's a bad guy. Yeah, he is a bad guy. He's not a nice guy. I wouldn't want him to marry my daughter. I really wouldn't. But I don't really care. I don't care. You showed me you don't care. Why should I care? Why should I care? Mitt Romney, like, probably stepped on somebody's toe. It's the worst thing he's ever done, right? He's going to get a little warm in hell for that. And Mitt Romney, Joe Biden said he's going to put you in chains. Remember that? Does anybody remember that? Mitt Romney killed grandma. He gave some grandma cancer, like cut off her medical care. They're going to put you all back in chains, right? Who cares anymore? Who cares? Who cares? Who cares? All the politicians from left and right, George W. Bush. Now, all of a sudden, George W. Bush is this like new, because he's against Trump. He's like, oh, he's this great guy. He he gets.
But wasn't he against Trump in 2016? It's just like was. Colin Powell. Like Colin Powell voted for Obama. It's like, why is this even a news?
Colin Powell was directly responsible for over 500,000 Iraqis losing their lives because he lied to the United Nations about weapons of mass destruction. Okay. George W. Bush started two wars that cost trillions of dollars of the U.S. Treasury and killed thousands of American troops and hundreds of thousands of Afghanistanis and Iraqis. But he gave candy to Michelle Obama. He does all these kooky jokes and he hates Trump. Oh my God.
Let's not forget the media hated his guts.
They hated
him. 2001 through 2009. And now because he's anti-Trump, they love him.
They love him. Trump.
Just like Mitt Romney.
Yeah, just like Mitt Romney, right? I go on this rant. I'm sorry I've done this rant before, but I can't stop. Once you start me, I can't stop. We got to end the episode soon. Barack Obama would drone strike people, okay? He turned Libya into open-air slave market. He almost started a war in Syria that would have been catastrophic. He took drones, and he killed American citizens with drones. He pushed that button. Boom. Like, he blew up weddings. He escalated a war in Yemen, right? And he had this huge troop surge in Afghanistan, which went nowhere and, like, accomplished nothing but, like, dead Afghanis and dead American troops, right? But Barack Obama, oh, and he was against gay marriage too. But then he came out for gay marriage after the election and danced with Ellen. And all of a sudden, it's like, what a great guy. What a great guy. Who cares? I don't, when anybody is like, Trump is like, who the fuck cares? Like, grow up. Okay. Grow up. Okay. These are people that do unscrupulous things because they have political power. Political power calls for getting your hands bloody. Okay. Yeah, Trump's a gross guy, but they're all gross. They're all gross. You don't want your daughter to marry anybody who's a politician. Okay. They're bad people in power because power corrupts them. Okay. There you go. I'm done with my rant. I'm sorry.
No.
You're a good kid. You know, you don't need to listen to this stuff. You just want to have a beer.
All fair points, Dane. But we went an hour and a half. There was a lot to talk about, and we pretty much got through, I think, everything I wanted to talk about. So I want to thank everybody for tuning in and listening or viewing us on the live stream or who are going to be tuning into us after the fact on our podcast. But, you know, just encourage everybody, if you go to Facebook, just search MV Red Podcast, like us. And, you know, we've been posting a lot of different things on there. Certainly encourage you to like us on there. Same with Twitter. And please tune into our podcast. I think this was a great. I like this episode a lot.
This was a good one. This was a really good one.
And you know, I didn't think this one was hyper partisan in any way, shape, or form. If anything, you know, we just hit Trump pretty hard here at the end with our disappointment. So, just encourage everybody. You know, keep sharing. Keep letting your friends know. We're 5 months away from the election, and we'll definitely increase the number of episodes we'll be doing. I think. And we're definitely going to have some guests on. We had a guest who was going to come on and discuss everything with us tonight who couldn't at the last minute. So we'll have him on another episode. And there's been a few other people I've been communicating with to try to get on. So we're going to definitely expand viewpoints in that respect. So any last words from you, Dane?
No. You know, if you're voting to defund the police department, good luck. You better believe in the Second Amendment because you're going to need it.
And I'll finish out with this. I think what'll be fascinating to watch, sort of like how we saw with that Minneapolis mayor yesterday, where he refused to give in to whatever the protest was arguing, whether it was defunding the police or whatever. What will Joe Biden do on that?
Joe Biden, you guys, listen to me, okay? This is really high IQ. Joe Biden in the CIA discovered the cure for racism. He had it, okay? And he was about to tell America, but then he forgot because he's senile.
There you have it.
There you have it.
All right, everybody, thank you so much for tuning in. And like I said, add us on social media. We'll give you updates on as to our next episode. But again, share this, let other people know, and thank you again for tuning in.
Okay,
bye. Take care, everybody.
Bye.